day, man, like you know.
Hello, listeners. This is David Blakesley, welcoming you to episode 145 of the Criterion Reflections podcast. This is a program in which I am going through the films associated with the Criterion Collection in the chronological order of their original theatrical release. And when I say associated with the Criterion Collection, I'm talking about not just the Blu-rays, DVDs, and now 4K discs that they put out that are, you know, pretty well-known and beloved, collected and all of that. But I'm also talking about films that they released way back when on Laserdisc, or some of the DVD titles that they released through the Eclipse series, kind of a sideline, or any other association with Criterion, including their streaming channel. And today's episode is kind of one of those latter categories, in which I'm going to be talking about Black Caesar, a 1973 film directed by Larry Cohen, starring Fred Williamson, and a pretty solid supporting cast, a James Brown soundtrack, a lot of elements that make this kind of a unique and pretty entertaining specimen of the blaxploitation genre. I'm going to format this episode into two segments, very similar to what we did with Wattstax, which was our previous episode, 144. The first segment is going to be me talking with my friend Richard Doyle. He is in Winnipeg, Manitoba, up there in Canada. A very frequent contributor, of course, to this show, and always appreciate the chance to chat with Richard. And then the second segment, again, as we did with Wattstax, is going to be a relatively new guest. It'll be his second appearance on the show, James Merritt from down in Atlanta, Georgia. James and I have gotten to know each other, as James has been a pretty prolific purveyor of videos and commentary and reviews of various Criterion and other brands, and we'll give James a chance to introduce himself when we get to that segment. But he's putting a lot of interesting content out there, and I've just really enjoyed getting to know him, and I've got some more work with him coming up in the future, so we'll talk about that in the episode. But yeah, this is one that I really enjoyed. You will hear, if you listen to the two segments, that I make some of the same points. I guess those are just my takes on the film. The conversations were recorded a couple, maybe even 3 weeks apart, just because of some scheduling things that came up. So I had not even recalled a lot of the details of my original conversation with Richard, so I went on to reinforce my opinions in part two, but that's okay. And there's also some pretty generous samples of that incredible James Brown soundtrack sprinkled throughout the episode. I definitely recommend checking out Black Caesar. If you haven't seen it, it is available on Pluto TV, one of those free streaming services. Of course, it's ad-supported, so you're going to have to put up with some breaks there. I'll have more to say about that. And also, if you really want to get the essence of the film, I recommend that you go to the comments page, or the show notes, I should say, on CriterionCast.com, which is where this podcast is hosted. I've posted a 3-minute video there that is really kind of a fan-made reduction of the essence of Black Caesar, set to the soundtrack of a song called The Boss by James Brown. So check that out, because it's a pretty entertaining clip that really kind of like I say, boils this film right down to its pure and slightly jaded heart. So yeah, that's basically my recommendation. If you haven't seen the whole thing, you can get the gist of it just with that little clip, and I'll have a few comments about that as well. So without further ado, here's the episode. Thanks for listening. Always appreciate feedback you may have. As we dig into blaxploitation, let's take it away with Black Caesar. All right, Richard, we are here to talk about Black Caesar. Well, how you doing today? Good. Welcome back to the show.
It's good to be back so soon, too.
Exactly. I'm not fooling anybody. We're just turning right around. So, yeah, so we are kind of, it's not really intended to be a series on black cinema from the 1973, but it is because these three films, what we just talked about, Wattstax, what we're talking about tonight, Black Caesar, what we're going to be talking about further down the road, The Harder They Come, three films really centered around black experience that came out in the first 2 weeks of February 1973. So there was a vibe in the air, right? And this one here, Black Caesar, definitely fits right into some of the films that you and I have talked about over the past few years as we get into the whole genre topic of blaxploitation. So you want to give us a little rundown? What's Black Caesar about? And again, you know, you can maybe intro the film and tell me a little bit about your first impressions. Have you seen it before? All of that.
Yeah. I have seen this film, but a long time ago, like maybe 20 years ago. It's Larry Cohen's second film.
After Bone, which we talked about, you know, a couple years ago, whenever that was, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Apparently this has its genesis as a project for Sammy Davis Jr.
Which is amazing, I think.
He approached Cohen. I think he approached Cohen because before even making Bone, Cohen has a history as a screenwriter for things like television and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So he's sort of been around Hollywood, and he wanted to do a film apart from the Dean Martin context, because he'd been doing quite a few films with Dean Martin, with the larger group and with just Dean Martin.
Yeah. Where he's always the sidekick. He's always just kind of, you know, the funny hip black guy, you know, doing his jivey thing over there. Right.
Yeah. Cohen pitched him the idea of let's do a modern take on a gangster film, thinking that Davis is a short guy and Edward G. Robinson and Jamie Cagney were short guys.
Yeah, Little Caesars, right, exactly.
So Black Caesar's conceived loosely as a blaxploitation version of Little Caesar. It doesn't really follow the plot of Little Caesar. If anything, got more elements of like Scarface in some of the plot points. But apparently then Davis got some IRS difficulties and couldn't pay for this. So
Cohen wanted to put up the money. So Sammy was going to be like a producer, basically, right?
Yeah. So Cohen sidelined it. But in the meanwhile, American International Pictures, like the B-movie factory, as it wanted, was looking for black action films in the fallout of Shaft and other films that came out in the first few years, like Superfly and stuff.
Yeah.
So they approached, one of the people they approached was Larry Cohen, because he'd made Bone with Yaphet Kotto.
Right.
And he's like, I've got a script, you know, which is very much Larry Cohen, right? Like small aside, in the early 80s, he spent a long time developing an adaptation of I, the Jury that did get made with Armand Arsante, but he got...
That's Mickey Spillane, right?
Yeah. So he got fired from it for different creative differences with the producers.
Okay.
And now that he had nothing to do, he turned around and got the movie Q, the Winged Serpent going in 2 weeks and was making another film 2 weeks after
So yeah,
getting fired from another one.
so let's talk a little bit about Larry Cohen because he is a character, and
Yeah.
I mentioned I was at a kind of a film screening gathering the other night, and I was just talking to a guy about my age, probably, about what I've been watching lately, and I mentioned Black Caesar. He's like, oh yeah, Larry Cohen, Fred Williamson. I was like, I wasn't expecting him to just be, and he did the whole the end scene, which we'll get to. I won't spoil that here, but yeah, he was quoting lines from the movie. It's like, wow, you're into this. This is great. He hadn't seen it in a long time either, but there were certain moments that really stood out in the memory for this guy. And I think Larry Cohen himself is kind of the character, even more than Fred Williamson or the soundtrack or, so tell us about Larry Cohen. What's his game here?
He is a real like low budget entrepreneur, I would say. Like mostly in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
He kind of sloped off into the 90s, although he did another blaxploitation comedy in the 90s.
Okay.
But he's very much, he's one of these guys where I get the feeling very much just wanted to make films where he had most of the say over the content of the film, so he wanted to do stuff cheap, fast, and he has a very strange sensibility at times. I mean, this film is relatively sedate for him. Like
Okay.
he specializes a lot in horror,
Yeah,
which I
he did
think,
It's Alive, right?
yeah,
That's, yeah.
and I think he's a little bit better at horror, partly because it lets him exercise some really weird ideas, like.
Okay,
He has a film in the 80s called The Stuff, which is about killer yogurt. And
Okay.
so he does things like
Yeah.
that, right?
Yeah. Kind
I
of a
also
crazy
think,
idea. He's just going to realize it. He's going to bring it to life and let's go with it, right? Okay.
And I also think he very much, he's a very fast and loose filmmaker, and I think horror survives that approach a little bit better than action.
Yeah.
I like this film, but I think this film is, like, the narrative is patchy to say the least,
Yeah.
and there are scenes where like he's very clearly, this is like one of his trademarks, is he does not get permits to shoot, and you can tell that he is just shooting on the streets of New York in this film.
Right. Yeah.
But that means the footage he gets is sometimes doesn't quite edit together.
But it's got that authenticity, if you will. I mean, when Fred Williamson and his guys are strolling down past the Apollo Theater in Harlem, and there's all the crowds around, and you got James Brown, I paid the cost to be the boss. I mean, that kind of kicks ass. That's a great sequence, Yeah.
I called my wife in to watch the scene where Fred Williamson gets shot in the long extended scene with the
Oh
ambulance
yeah.
shoot too, partly because you can tell
Yeah.
that passerbys are legitimately trying to help Fred Williamson,
Right.
which
Here's
is
this good-looking
wonderful.
dude in a suit. He's got blood coming out, and they're like, "Whoa, what is going on?" Of course. Yeah. So Larry Cohen, I mean, what struck me is that here's a Jewish guy writing pretty racially charged dialogue. A lot of it funny, but in a kind of I can't believe they just said that kind of way, and it just it's and he's just rolling with it. I there's a part of me that's like, okay, so this is a kind of a form of cultural appropriation. Not that I'm going to get real hung up over that, but it's like, he's putting words in the mouths of these black characters that are pretty self-deprecating and again using kind of racial slang and stuff like that. And it's like, okay, he's but you could say from a sort of a correctness point of view, he's a little bit out of his lane, but he's just kind of gutsy and ballsy, and it's like, he's just going to plow through. It's like, okay, blaxploitation's that thing, here's my blaxploitation film for you, and he's gonna play off all those stereotypes, and you've got the whole checklist of all the stuff. You've got your erotic, lovemaking scene. You got your gunfights, you got your, banter dialogue, you've got your kind of mafioso takeoff stuff, where again, this is another film like we talked about with The Boss, the Fernando Di Leo, an Italian mafia movie, made in Palermo in Sicily, the home of it. And there's all this kind of Godfather crossover stuff going on there, where they've got the little, the mandolin playing there. And you can tell that the Godfather and the shadow of that sensational massive blockbuster hit, which spawned all of these mafia clone movies after that, is being referred to here. So he's really kind of playing with the zeitgeist of mafia crime movies and blaxploitation, kind of merging them together about this kind of street waif, this kind of hard pressed kid who comes up out of nowhere, you know, fueled by his desire for vengeance. He's got some paybacks that he wants to lay down there, and that's the genesis of the Fred Williamson character, you know, the Black Caesar here. So very, very audacious. He's taken on material, and just, like I say, you know, kind of maybe giving the audience what he thinks they want. And I think this movie did pretty well. Is that
it? Did yes, it did for sure. Yeah. I think part of what, I mean, the studios and, but especially like the lower budget folks like AIP learned from many movies, like I'd say Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. Is that there's a real inner city audience that nobody was catering to.
Right. Right?
You know, the whole assumption was you make the films that cater to the wider audience and we'll play them everywhere. But they learned that you could make a ton of money putting, you know, movies mostly in inner city theaters in major urban centers. And there's lots of reason to think something like this played really well.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
It's true that, you know, the people behind it are usually like not just white, but also predominantly in the lower budget films in the industry, like Jewish fellas, like the people behind AIP. Mm-hmm. But they're showmen and they kind of playing to what they know really works. And I think part of the reason that this film's a little run and gun and doesn't make a lot of sense, it didn't always matter, you know,
right. No, you just,
to an audience paying a few bucks to see something that's a little thrilling. It doesn't, they're not going to sit there and nitpick the plot for sure.
Right. Right. You basically, you give them all the different set pieces. So you've got the shootouts, you've got the, I've heard, kind of already made that point there. So, you know, it's the whole smorgasbord of what you look for in kind of a hip, black, conscious gangster movie, you know, including that the whole kind of up in the man, you know, and kind of, you know, getting revenge on Whitey, getting revenge on the cops, getting revenge on the mafia, the runners, you know, the Italians that are kind of, you know, squeezing them out and controlling the game. I mean, all Black Caesar wants is his little block. He just wants his little piece of turf where he can be the man. And, you know, I'm sure there's a number of folks in the audience, kind of like with Scarface, or people who sort of identify affirmatively with what this character is about, you know?
Yeah.
It's a fantasy version, of course. And then there's probably some people who really are living some kind of a criminally inflected life, and this was like kind of taking that to a whole nother level.
I had a friend who lived in New York City in this period, right?
Sure. Okay.
He wasn't talking about blaxploitation films in this case, but he was talking about Bruce Lee films in the early 70s that he'd go to the inner city theaters to watch them in. Audience members would be standing up and shouting at the screen.
Like, oh yeah, right. Yeah.
Get him.
Yeah, cheering him on, you know. Yeah. And even the side characters, you know, you got your brain guy, the black kid with glasses.
Yeah.
So he's the money man. You know, he's the guy who's keeping all the accounts and the numbers together. But you talked a little bit about the sketchiness of the plot. I mean, the fact that, you know, Black Caesar's power is that he's got these ledger books.
Yes.
That's like his invincibility. So as long as he's got those books with all the names, and so you're just imagining these mafia crime lords writing in pencil the names of all the politicians and judges and business tycoons that are, you know, on the take there.
In his defense, though,
yeah,
that's
yeah.
also a plot point in Brian De Palma's Untouchable, so
sure.
I do think Cohen knows classic gangster films because he's got all the right ingredients here.
Yeah,
he's just kind of throwing them into a pile at times.
Yep.
Along with, you know, severed ears onto plates of spaghetti and things.
Exactly. Yeah. Your noodles needed more meat. Yeah. So, well, let's talk about. Oh, you were gonna Yes,
I
it
was
does
also
it.
going to
Yeah.
say, it's. I think it's hilarious that this is supposedly set in the mid-60s without any effort to make it period at all.
Right. Yeah, they put the dates out there, you know, the beginning, sort of middle, not the middle, but yeah, it's like, what, 53 when the kid is introduced, 65 when you see, Black Caesar kind of making his first big hit. You know, he kind of picks up the word on the street that there's a underboss who needs to be taken out, so he's going to go in and just do the job himself and barge his way into the mafioso.
Yeah. A few minutes after they establish that it's supposedly the 50s, the kid is sitting and listening to the James Brown soundtrack on a radio.
Exactly. And the fashions don't really change at all either. I mean, the street clothes is pretty much all early 70s, actually, not even late 60s or mid 60s. So, and then the film kind of ends with was August something 1972. So a few months prior to this film's actual release is when the story supposedly came to its end. Let's talk a little bit about Fred Williamson. He's a former NFL player. He became pretty stock, you know, guy in a lot of, you know, black-oriented films, not all of them blaxploitation. This might be one of his hardest-edged performances.
Yeah, he is in MASH, first of all.
Yeah.
Right? And then sort of follows the Jim Brown route of going into film. And
yep.
He does, besides this, he does some blaxploitation westerns, two, one of which is a title I will not say.
Oh, yeah. Black Charlie. Well, it actually played on the Criterion Channel. They had that kind of black western thing several, probably a year or two, a couple years ago. Yeah, but the legend of N-word Charlie, I guess if listeners are wondering what we're kind of debating here.
There's more than one because that's not even the one I was thinking of.
Okay.
There's another one, Boss N-word.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. Okay.
But, Williamson's an interesting guy because he, let's say, by the late 70s, the blaxploitation craze is over. But not for Fred Williamson, because he ends up like spending decades after that pretty much acting and starring and producing in his own like cheap blaxploitation films for many years after this.
Yeah.
And he sort of got his own little industry of his own little cheap action films that he kept doing for decades, which is sort of an interesting holdout. I don't know that he's terribly successful at it, but successful enough to have kept going.
It was probably the best avenue for earning a fairly comfortable living, you know? I mean, you think about, you know, black filmmakers. I mean, Tyler Perry is one that comes to mind. Now, he is incredibly wealthy and successful making films, you know, for the black community, and probably is global at this point. You know, I think he's got a lot of appeal, but he's not somebody that you talk about, you know, much in serious cinephile circles or critical, you know, acclaim and all of that. But I'm sure Fred Williamson had his audience that was like, oh, you know, trusted name brand entertainment at this point. He's a very good looking guy, you know, and I think once he kind of got it down, you know, he knew what he had to do to get on camera and hold attention and, you know, play the role. This one here, though, there is some cathartic elements going on here, you know, especially that ending scene where he's really cutting loose. And then this is where the story kind of conveniently comes full circle. I mean, there's a kind of a crooked cop at the beginning of the film that, you know, brutally abuses and takes advantage of this kid who's been kind of getting involved in some, you know, some street crime stuff, and he ends up taking a job, if you will, to sort of interfere with the victim, a guy who's got a contract on him. He said, hold his leg while you're shining his shoes so that my gunman can take him out. But in the meantime, you know, he does that, and he's there to collect his money, get paid, but then the crooked cop, who comes back later on as a kind of an upper level, you know, commissioner type, you know, basically breaks his leg, gives him a limp, and again, that's the fuel for revenge that kind of motivates the rest of the plot. Well, at the end of the story, there's a pretty, you know, climactic scene where the kid, now a grown man, gets his revenge. And it's kind of spoilery, but it's also pretty pretty amazing. I don't know, how much do we want to get into the whole the blackface thing that goes on there?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that sequence, yeah. I was thinking of the very end, which...
Oh, yeah. Well, we can talk about the final, because there's some questions about that. But, you know, where you know, basically, Fred Williamson is beating the crap out of this cop, this old Irish cop, kind of another stereotype, if you will, with his shoeshine box, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, all of the...
Because he forces him to do the shoe shining.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Because that was his. That was going to be the cop's kind of closing the circle. It's like, yeah, I remember you, kid. Well, we're gonna, you know, just humiliate you one last time before I kill you, and then the tables are turned. And so it's like, you know, it is definitely theatrical, over the top. It's a sort of a manufactured gimmicky thing, but. There's a certain power in that scene as well. And again, it's a Jewish guy telling a black story, but you know, we talked earlier about giving the audience what they want. And that's the kind of scene that's going to get certain people standing up in their chairs and shouting and pumping their fist as they kind of see the tables turned and old grudges settled.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. You want to talk about the final scene? I mean, there was a sequel made to this movie, and yet this film doesn't really give you the impression that there's room to go with that.
But there's a reason for that, which I didn't know until right now.
Okay.
Like when I was researching the film this time. So apparently there's a sequel because this did so well that AIP immediately asked Cohen to do a sequel.
Yep.
And in fact asked him to get it going as quick as he could so that people like Fred Williamson didn't realize how successful it was and asked for money, right? So Cohen apparently
hustler all the way through.
So Cohen apparently started making, like, said to them, "Well, I could start today. I don't have a script, but we could just start making it and figure it out when we're going after going along." So that's what they did with the sequel, Hell Up in Harlem.
Right.
But it doesn't seem like there is room, because if you watch it now, like, Williamson dies at the end.
It seems like it. You could say maybe
in the theatrical cut.
Yeah,
that ending wasn't in the film when it played theatrically, and I didn't know that until just recently. It only played in Europe with that ending.
How interesting. Okay, so was there another ending that kind of just kept the character alive and ready to, you know, go on to chapter two or something?
I assume it might have just ended more around the time that he kills the cop and says sort of what?
Yeah. Right? Yeah, because, you could excise that last scene, which is basically him, because he's still been shot. He hasn't really recovered. I mean, that's the other thing, too, sometimes. You know, one shot and these people are just out. This guy takes it, like, right there, right up close, and he doesn't bleed out or nothing. He just staggers around for a little while, and then he seems to do okay.
He covers about half of the city with that bullet wound in him.
Until this group of young kids, kind of just the reversal or the image of who he was at the beginning of the film, they surround him, kind of taunt him, beat him up, steal his watch, and you figure Black Caesar at his moment of triumph has met his ignominious end. And there is kind of a certain symmetry to, you know, the story coming around that way. And you know, kind of tragic character, live fast, die young, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, you can see that it fits the arc of, like, a classic gangster film. So you can see why he put that ending. He's just got the great irony that the kids just throw the ledgers on the ground.
Yeah, exactly. All that power, all the you know, the key to his dominance of this crime scene is just sitting there with all the other trash in this, you know, godforsaken back alley there.
For years, though, I've admired his audacity at just doing Hell Up in Harlem with a character that he killed in the previous film, not realizing that most people didn't think he was dead.
Right. Yeah, and you could say maybe he was just beaten unconscious. I want to watch, maybe I will watch Hell Up in Harlem before I record the next segment there. All right, so other thoughts on the film? I mean, this is not one I think that, like you sort of said already, Richard, doesn't really stand under the weight of close scrutiny
and
analysis, you know?
It's a combination of Cohen's never the most thorough plotter. Like, even in films of his that I think are better than this one, the plot's kind of a little bit loose.
Right? Yeah.
And I think his tendency to steal shots means he gets what he can. And in the editing room, especially in the scene I'm talking about, I was talking about earlier, where Williamson is shot and there's an ambulance chase and stuff.
Yeah, right.
He clearly did not get enough footage for that sequence.
Right. And a lot of it is just like, where is this even going and how does he get from point A to point B? Yeah. If you really stop and try to reconstruct, and I'm sure if you knew the city and the blocks of Harlem and Upper Manhattan, you'd say, this just makes no sense whatsoever, you know.
I'll certainly say for it, if you really dive into blaxploitation films, you'll find a lot of cheap films out there. And this is
comes with the territory, right?
This is pretty good for the territory.
Yeah.
And it's enjoyable despite its flaws. I think it helps that Williamson is a pretty magnetic lead.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I found this film really entertaining. It definitely kept my interest the whole time, and I've watched it a couple times now, and it's like, yeah, I dig it. You know, it's definitely, it's got a lot of, you know, that audacity, that kind of go for broke, let's just kind of, you know, load up the film and make it happen and, you know, get the best takes we can and have some fun with it. And so just in that spirit, and also I think just, it, again, tapping into the consciousness of its times, and this is not an honorable way necessarily to make your way in the world, but there is just enough of that kind of humor and kind of thumb in the nose at the entrenched powers, a young black man who's overly confident, but also just audacious enough to say, yeah, I'm going to go for it. Well, what have I got to lose? I mean, I think that's just another piece that, you know, audiences could identify positively with this guy who's, and again, living out a little bit of a fantasy, a daydream, just going for broke and enjoying the ride for as long as it lasts.
I should definitely shout out that I mentioned that Cohen returned to this genre in the late 90s.
Okay.
Reteaming with Fred Williamson. He made a film in 96 called Original Gangstas.
Okay. Which, again, tapping into the gangster rap thing, right? Okay,
Which involves the older Fred Williamson going back to his neighborhood and taking on young people when his neighborhood is being, like, threatened.
And okay.
Not just Cohen with Fred Williamson, Jim Brown, Pam Grier.
Oh,
Richard Roundtree and Ron O'Neill.
That's amazing. So it's basically the Hall of Fame of blaxploitation.
Yeah. Paul Winfield and Isabel Sanford and some
other. I gotta go check that out. Yeah, I
Robert Forster's in it too.
Okay, yeah. So I think I've probably seen posters or maybe old video VHS tapes back in the day. And are they interacting with kind of like, you know, the hip hop gangster rap kids of the 90s? Yeah, I could just see it.
It's very much the blaxploitation heroes taking on youth crime in the late 90s.
Yeah, and again, so for a black audience of, you know, kind of the older parents, and they see their kids going down this road, whatever, whether it's serious gang involvement or just adopting the style, which of course was a huge thing back then, you sort of have this generational flip here, you know, these guys who were, you know, just the studliest dudes of their time in the early to mid 70s, and now, you know, the generations take their turn, and it's now they're the crotchety old guard watching how things have gone downhill since then. I can just imagine it. Yeah, that's great. And let's talk about the James Brown soundtrack, because that's another crucial component. I mean, I don't know if I think there was one song, the Down and Out in New York City, which actually has writing credits by Barry DeVorzin, who I think did a lot of you know, soundtrack music and movie themes. He was kind of another commercial insider Hollywood guy. So, but James Brown, I mean, he makes that song sound like his own, and I think he did a few of those other ones, you know, Paid the Cost to Be the Boss, and with another couple tunes that are kind of pretty iconic through the soundtrack there.
Kind of call back the Watt Stacks conversation and say one of the great things about blaxploitation is, since there wasn't a huge white audience for a lot of really major black musicians. They really do soundtrack. There's some wonderful soundtracks for pretty cheap films in this genre. The notion that that AIP could do this sort of run and gun little blaxploitation gangster film and get James Brown to do the soundtrack feels incredible nowadays.
It is, and it's a really good album. The whole album is it's like a soundtrack album, but it's part of James Brown's regular catalog, you know? And it's really good. I mean, there's some really nice scenes, and not all of it is just kind of street funk stuff. There's like the Mama's Dead song, and there's some kind of soundtracky stuff. But it's just it really kicks. It's a great record there. It lays down. I think that's another really important piece. It gives the film that sense of, real street level authenticity, and it just it's lively. It really energizes the whole thing whenever the soundtrack kicks in.
I think it's wonderful.
All right. Well, I think we've pretty much given this one a pretty nice piece of coverage. I'm going to have another conversation with my friend James Merritt coming up after this, and we'll kind of get his perspectives on blaxploitation. So, Richard, as always, it's a great honor and privilege to have you on. Really enjoyed our conversation. So, thanks again for hanging in there with me.
Yeah, enjoy this.
All right. See ya.
Get down.
All right.
Cost to be the boss. Paid the cost to be the boss. I paid the cost to be the boss. Look at me. You know what you see. You see a bad mother. Look at me. You know what you see. You see a bad mother. Cost to be the boss. Paid the cost to be the boss. Look at me. Know what you see? See a bad mother.
All right, I am back for part two of this conversation about Black Caesar. And I'm here once again, as we did with the Wattstax episode previously, with my friend James Merritt. James, hello, and welcome back to the show.
Hello, David. Yes, definitely glad to be back. I really do appreciate the invite and enjoyed the last conversation on Wattstax, and really looking forward to talking about this film, Black Caesar.
Excellent. Well, for folks who maybe haven't listened to that episode yet, I want to kind of give you a chance to introduce yourself since you're relatively new on my cast of supporting characters here. So tell listeners what James Merritt's doing online and in the world of cinema.
Well, sure. I am currently, I love talking about film and movies and cinema on the internet. Of course, I'm on Instagram, Facebook. I run a YouTube channel called 20th and 21st Movies. We are about all things cinema. We cover a variety of cinematic topics, but have a particular focus on the Criterion Collection physical media releases. We'll hopefully be doing some coverage of the Criterion Channel soon, but a lot of coverage on reviews of Criterion Collection titles that are coming out. Covering the Criterion Collection sales, Barnes & Noble, and as well as the flash sales throughout a couple that happened during the year. And then also covering, other notable boutique labels like Arrow Video and Kino Lorber releases as well. So just love talking all things cinema and, love classic movies from, all eras and different genres of cinema. So love talking about movies.
All right, well, I will post links to all your socials in the show notes here on CriterionCast.com and give listeners a chance to check up with you. I know you got a episode planned for tomorrow for the new Arrow release drop. You did a pretty nice episode on the July Criterion titles coming out. So
yes,
got a nice little archive that you're building there. But we're going to turn our attention to a film that was on the Criterion Channel for a limited run. It's gone there now. I watched it on Pluto TV. This is Black Caesar. So James,
I did too.
yeah, this, yeah, Pluto's kind of the go-to place for this one, unless you want to plunk down some money and buy the disc, and maybe one of these days I'll do that. But you know, it was a pretty nice opportunity. You got to put up with some ads and interruptions, but they at least seem to have the ads at a reasonable break. You know, sometimes you watch these freebies and tubies and stuff, and the ad will just pop up in the craziest time. It's like, you got to be kidding me. But is anybody even watching the movie while they're showing when to insert the ad? But this one here, it's kind of like old school TV, you know, kind of comes to a dramatic pause, and then boom, here comes a word from our sponsor. But mm-hmm. anyways, formatting aside, what did you think about Black Caesar? Had you seen this movie before?
I've seen bits and pieces of it, as well as a lot of these types of films throughout the years. And yeah. This is probably my first time sitting down and watching it all the way through. Of course, when I say all the way through, it's over multiple, viewings,
sure.
you know, catching, you know, 15 minutes here, 20 minutes here. And it is really an intense film. I mean, it is mm-hmm. a lot of deep themes going on in this movie. I love this overall genre and time in cinema, this era of early 70s films in this particular space of, you know, black exploitation cinema. I love like the performances of actors like, you know, Fred Williamson at the time, Pam Grier, just some of the, you know, the luminaries during this time. But this is really a fascinating film that tells a story that's been told in, you know, a number of films, you know, throughout the years. I think this film was sort of a bit of a remake or inspired from an early 1930s film, I think.
Yeah, Little Caesar, right.
Little Caesar. Mm-hmm. And it's been, you know, similar stories like this have been told in other, you know, films that I love as well, like American Gangster, Denzel Washington starred in that, you know, New Jack City, you know, Scarface, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's just a really fascinating story that really just tells you that, you know, crime just doesn't pay. And this whole rise to the top that these people, you know, go through as part of their arc. I've never seen any example of them actually being happy when they get there.
Right. Oh yeah. There's always that kind of inner conflict that can never quite be resolved, you know? But you're right. This is the proverbial rags to riches story. The young kid who has a little chip on his shoulder, starts off with nothing, gets put down by the man. I mean, it's a pretty perfect setup as far as the opening here. You've got a young boy who's out there, an African-American young man, in the streets of Harlem. He's given shoe shines, which, you know, has a certain subservient, servile, and somewhat degrading aspect to it. Because mm-hmm. it's not just the fact that you're bowing down to shine the shoes. It's the way you're being talked to, the way you're being looked at. And
yes.
and he's doing it. He's just scrapping, hustling any little, you know, nickel and dime that he can. But mm-hmm. he's got a little scheme going here. He's targeted a particular man to shine his shoes. And when the time comes, he holds onto that guy's leg to set him
yep.
up for an assassination, basically. A sinister kind of gangster figure emerges from a dark doorway, pulls his gun, and the guy wants to make a run for it. But there's young Tommy Gibbs kind of holding on and making sure he doesn't get away. And there's
yep.
a little payoff at the end, right? So,
yep.
yeah, but it's a payoff that gives him kind of quick riches, but then also a pretty severe beatdown when he, you know, he runs into a crooked cop, McKinney.
McKinney, yes.
Exactly, McKinney, who thinks he's shorted him $50 from the bribe that he slipped him in this envelope.
Yeah.
And, you know, you see a very early revelation of Tommy Gibbs' character, the way he sasses talking back to the cop, which is like a pretty gutsy, fearless thing to do, kind of risky and foolhardy too, you know. But what did you think about is the way they established that character right from the get-go?
I think they did a nice job of, you know, putting you, you know, in the shoes of this young man, you know, what he was doing, you know, at this particular time, and just showing his, you know, his humble beginnings, and, you know, which, you know, it's really interesting that you see the beginning of the character, excuse me,
mm-hmm.
but then I love how they come back you know, in the end to this, you know, similar place, you know, in you know, what they do at the end there. But I really do like the way they establish, you know, where he comes from and, you know, the what sort of the motivation for him going on to pursuing this rise to power and, you know, taking over the you know, organized crime in this section of the, you know, the city in New York City and, you know, what he thinks will give him happiness and give happiness to other people like his mother, which I love the story of his mother.
And,
you know, he's thinking that, you know, you don't have to be a maid anymore. You know, I've made it. I can give you everything you want. And, and realizing that doesn't make her happy. It's not going to make her happy.
Right.
She is in a mindset. I've always been a maid and, you know, and which is, you know, similar to a lot of people can be stuck in a mindset like that and not be able to, you know, see themselves as anything other than that because they're so conditioned to, you know, think a certain way. And also I think she was, you know, opposed to it because what he was doing was, you know, criminal.
Right. She knew that
he might have been more amenable to taking the money if it was, you know, if it was gained, you know, through more noble means, you know, so to speak.
Yeah, well, and that's kind of the moral dilemma that's going on throughout this entire film is that, you know, corruption just kind of runs through everything. And, and Tommy's decision from a young age, and in fact, when he's sitting there in his hospital bed, recuperating from the beating that the cop gave him, which kind of gave him a permanent leg injury, a disability, which, you know, sometimes you see Fred Williamson strutting around and he's just walking like the athletic guy that he is. And it's like everyone's like, oh, yeah, he's supposed to have a bad leg there. but you know, that's the kind of the wounds, the scars, the trauma that he's carrying along with him. But as he's sitting there recuperating, he's already scheming right now. I'm going to be going to jail. He's got his friend, this young man with glasses, who's like the brain, you know, the numbers guy. I want you to study how to make money so that when I get into my business, you can help me multiply this cash into, you know, a big high-rolling bank account. And so he's got this scheme, but he wants to jump on the corruption train because he says that's how things operate in this world, you know. You got to get in on the graft, and that's basically his whole path to the top is getting the inside dirt on these politicians and judges and celebrities and the books. That's right. Yeah, the ledgers, you know.
The ledgers,
you love it. Like, they're just writing the actual names and all the dirty money and all the businesses, like, right there. And those books are just, like, worth their weight in gold, you know, because that's the stuff that will, you know, sink the whole ship if it hits the newspapers or whatever. It's a bit of a MacGuffin, I guess, as they could say. You know, it's like, you know, these guys have attorneys and there'd be all kinds of monkey business to just kind of make these charges go away. But for the sake of the plot, you know, those books are kind of the core to his power. That's what makes him untouchable. But I just kind of love the scheming and the paybacks that go on here to elevate Tommy to, you know, kind of getting his share of the pie. He doesn't want to take over the mafia as a whole. He just wants his block. You know, give me that and I'm good and I'll be the guy that, you know, can, you know, because they also play the racial element here. You know, the mob at that point is run by old Italian syndicate families. But, you know, you need a black guy because the world is changing, you know, and you can't just send your, you know, Vito and Bruno down there to do the dirty work. You got to have a guy on the inside. And it does touch on some of those racial issues. We don't hire, you know, black people. They put it a little bit more bluntly in the movie. But that kind of stuff is kind of pretty central to the story as well, how he's kind of overcoming some of the racism and the prejudice and the closed doors to kind of kick them open on his own terms. And, you know, I just kind of think, you know, there had to be an audience that was identifying with this guy, with this cool cat saying, you go, man, you go, Tommy Gibbs, you know, pursue that dream.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many issues here with that, just sort of, you know, interlaced together with the corruption and the power and how that isolates, you know, people, and that, you know, because of the corruption, you know, it did isolate him and put distance between him and his mother. Mm-hmm. He couldn't, because of the way he, got with Gloria Hendry's mm-hmm. Helen, his mm-hmm. wife. They never really had a truly functional relationship because there was distance there, based on how he used her to, along the way to get the ledger, so to speak.
Right. And, she was his inside track there to kind of, she was like the secretary or whatever to this kind of conspiracy there. And he kind of used his friendship with her to bust in and get those books.
Yeah, so all that corruption angle, and then also, of course, the whole race issue and the mm-hmm. racial tensions and the, just the whole systemic, racism and oppression that was faced by, a lot of, African Americans, which is, part of what was motivating him. But this, movie sort of tells you that, yeah, these are real issues, but what he's doing in response to him is not, two wrongs don't make a right, so
right,
to speak. You know?
Right, yeah. There is kind of a cartoonish aspect to just how exaggerated everything is. I mean, we talked about the ledgers as kind of like this device, but it's also, I don't like to use this word too often, but sort of that iconic presentation, because there are so many shots of Tommy Gibbs. And again, you've got Fred Williamson, this very handsome, athletic, studly guy. He's kind of like, he's got the whole package going on there as far as his looks, his swagger, his confidence.
He's still with us today.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And he had
86 years old.
Yeah, and he had a fantastic long career. And this, I think, was probably one of his key star-making roles, because mm-hmm. he's doing it all. He's doing the action bits. He's doing the gangster swag stuff, he's looking stylish. He can be funny at times. I mean, there's a lot of humor that it's like you're laughing, but you're cringing, because it's like, it's just so wrong, But it's just like, but he, he really does epitomize this role quite exceptionally. And in a sense is kind of, he's almost like living out a masculine fantasy, right? I mean, although you got to pay the piper at the end, but it's going to be quite a ride until we get to that day of reckoning.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that really got me into this movie and really just really set the mood and the tone of this film for me was that James Brown soundtrack. Oh,
I can go on about that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh my goodness. Those songs. Yep, and I think one song that I will never forget is that one, Mama's Dead.
Yeah.
I mean, that mm-hmm. It just sort of hits you to the core. It's just like, oh my goodness,
Right. Because it exposes the hollowness. I mean, he's got all the money. Yeah. You're talking about the scene where he's kind of, showering his mother with this new apartment. It was the very apartment where she worked as a maid. I mean, it's like, again, brilliant setup, but she's coming in to bring, the owner of the apartment, this attorney guy, his breakfast and do her usual, morning greetings and stuff. And she pulls back the sheets and there's her son. Mama, here I am. I did this for you, And she's like, I will not take this tainted, gift that you're giving me, because she's got mm-hmm. her principles. She's got her values, and she did her best. She didn't raise him up like that, but it's a dirty world out there. And even the mother with her best intentions, she's got another son who's kind of gone off into a sort of a bunk religious kind of thing, Reverend Rufus there. And there's some pretty cynical takes on all of that, which I think you can definitely push back and say, let's not indulge too much in these stereotypes, but for the sake of the story, they throw it out there in pretty blunt, pretty raw form. But the fact that he, and then there's that scene where he's throwing all these fur coats off the balcony. I mean, just total indulgence, because it's like he doesn't really know what to do once he's got there. He's got the money, he's got the power, he's able to write a check and pay cash and buy off this apartment. And, he's kind of flexing in a pretty, pretty significant way. And yet that emptiness, that vacuum at the center of it all is still there. Never quite gets filled in.
Yeah, it's just the old classic, the love of money is the root of all evil, and certainly the lust for power is definitely something that can corrupt a person. And so many times people they finally get to the mountain, and they get there, and they have everything that they think that they wanted. And in the back of their mind, they're thinking, why am I still not happy?
Yeah, exactly.
Why are the people around me not happy? I just thought it was so devastating just seeing that scene at, his mother's funeral, and just like thinking, wow, she left this world, knowing her son, had been corrupted despite everything she did to try to raise him right. And he him being devastated, knowing that despite everything that he was trying to do, as well intentioned as he in his demented, corrupted mind was trying to be, he couldn't make her happy. And I just that just broke me just seeing that.
And the finality of it is like there's no second chance. You can't go back and give her, one more hour, one more day.
She tried so hard to make me a respectable man. She didn't really know me, and she didn't really understand. She worked like a slave and prayed hard every day. What did I do for her? Now she's gone. Her troubles are over. The pain is gone. I wish I had made her proud to call me son.
She's gone, and I think even Reverend Rufus has a moment of kind of comeuppance. He's been kind of cynically exploiting the people and, throwing the hallelujahs and the amens out there, but in kind of a hypocritical sense. And he himself recognizes that, here I am playing with all this religious stuff, and yet I got to ask those questions, where is this really going? And I may get the laughs now, but who's going to get the last laugh is kind of there. But let's talk more about that James Brown soundtrack, because that honestly has been like the earworm that's just been consuming me over these last few weeks since I watched the movie. I mean, I watched the movie and I said, oh, that's a pretty great soundtrack, but it has been just kind of, inhabiting me. I mean, the boss, paid the cost to be the boss, and that incredible bass line and that little chicken scratch guitar. It's like
Oh, good.
it's so boiled down to its essence. That's the thing that gets me is like, you can come up with a great hook line and you can get the band jamming along, but James Brown and the JBs, they just had a way of cutting away all the fat and just getting right to the funk, right to the beat there. And James Brown, I mean, his vocals, it's like, yeah, he's got a great line, he's got a great delivery, but it's just that little that kind of stuff. It's like his timing is just like impeccable. It says so much in so few words.
Yeah, I mean, this soundtrack to me makes this film. I mean, as I mean, I would put it almost up there with, Isaac Hayes, Shaft soundtrack for, for the soundtrack for Shaft. I mean, it's just so impactful. I mean, it's so much so that if you take it away, this movie isn't, it just doesn't have, it doesn't resonate, as much as it would without it, which I guess is the case for a lot of films. The soundtrack and the music and the cues, oftentimes are a huge part of these films, but I think even more so with in the case of like Black Caesar or Shaft, is really a bigger part of the experience.
Now, there's a sequel made to this movie called Hell Up in Harlem.
Hell Up in Harlem.
Have you ch checked that one out?
I've seen parts of it. It's been a long time since I've seen it.
Honestly, yeah. Well, go ahead. I'm finishing out there.
Oh, no, go ahead, please. Go
Well,
ahead.
I was gonna say. So I tried watching it because I figured, okay, so the way Black Caesar goes, it doesn't really set yourself up for a sequel there. But
Right.
this character caught fire with the audience, and they figured we gotta cash in while it's hot. And so,
Yeah, they left that ending sort of without a definitive, did he, or not? So, yeah.
But I mean, the ledgers are in the in you know in that empty lot there. It looks like he got pretty well beat down. And he's already been shot. Remember, he got shot in the side. He's been staggering around town,
Yeah,
since
got in a
the
taxi and all
afternoon.
that.
He has that whole overnight thing where he's meeting with McKinney, the shoe shine, the mammy, all of that. I mean, an incredible cathartic release. All that rage, all that fury just comes pouring out. He's been carrying that burden since his boyhood, and now here he is face to face with the man who kind of set him on this path, and he just lets it rip. Again, a pretty powerful scene, but then after all that, he's still got this untreated gunshot wound in his side, but and then he's surrounded by a bunch of kids who kind of all they see is a guy with a nice suit on and a fancy watch, and they're going to give him a hard time and take what they can. And that is kind of like the arc of the story, But they made this film Hell Up in Harlem, but apparently, and they had commissioned James Brown to do another soundtrack, but when James Brown gave him the songs, which turned into his double album, The Payback, which I think a lot of people consider to be one of his peaks, and there's the Live at the Apollo and all of that. But for his 70s stuff, The Payback is a incredible record. Each of the songs is like between 7 and 12 minutes, so extended funk jams, not some of the more tight, crisp soundtrack music that we have in Black Caesar, which was released as a single album. But they didn't like his soundtrack for Hell Up in Harlem, so they passed that up and got another kind of more conventional. And I guess if you're a fan of kind of cheesy 70s made for TV movie type of soundtracks, Hell Up in Harlem will give you what you're looking for. But to me, it was such a come down from what I was accustomed to, because you're right. The James Brown soundtrack elevates this to almost classic status in a way, because the story is so it's so pure in its own way, and it's tragic, but it's also funny. It's violently shocking, and it's morally kind of bracing, because you're kind of seeing a guy live out his dream. And he stirs up all those thoughts. But when you've got a much more mediocre soundtrack that's trying to sort of emulate some of that, but really goes into some sappy territory, it just breaks the spell. So yeah, I think that
100%.
the image and the music and the performances really are what makes this, I think, a pretty, I'm not going to say this is one of the great movies, or one of the classic. Well, it's a classic of its genre, I would think. I haven't seen, I'm not deep into blaxploitation, but this just seems to me like it's got the ingredients to make this one of the kind of one of the best, or at least a
Absolutely.
pretty great example of what the genre can do.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, as you're saying, Williamson did such a great job. I mean, what a just he has such had such amazing charisma and just was so magnetic on screen. And just, I thought he was fantastic. I thought Gloria Hendry, Helen, was wonderful. I really enjoyed her performance. And just, I mean, just playing the wife and, in this movie, and who, of course, none of the relationships in this film work for Tommy. I mean, it didn't work with her, didn't work with his mother. His father is a whole thing as well. I mean, just that dysfunction and just that very tragic story,
Yeah, now Julius Harris, you mentioned the father. He was also the father in Nothing But a Man, which you and I have kind of talked about a little bit there from earlier in the 60s. Did you make that connection there?
I did not make that
No,
connection. Okay, it's the same actor.
it's the
Okay.
same guy. Yeah, it was he was the father of the protagonist, the lead guy in Nothing But a Man. And and so that's another interesting element of the father-son tensions. You know, the dad was kind of off doing his thing, so Tommy, the young Tommy, didn't really have a lot of that, masculine guidance in his coming up, his development. And so there's issues, there's tensions there. But the dad has his side of the story too. It wasn't as easy. It wasn't like I just walked away. But you get into some of that nitty-gritty stuff between young men and their fathers, and fathers and their kind of wayward sons, and trying to work things out at a later stage of life. I mean, I've gone through my own version of that, in a certain sense with my dad. And I mean, again, a lot of people in the audience, I'm sure, could relate to just kind of that situation and how it was being presented there.
And just seeing, get on before I change my mind, and I don't ever want to see you again. And then, of course, he does come back into frame at a very poignant point at the kind of, paying respects to, his mother. And then you see it just, I mean, just how Tommy is at that point so desperate to connect to somebody, who's supposed to be meaningful in his life, and just saying, Daddy, you need anything? Do you want to come stay with me? Just grasping for straws to have any kind of a meaningful connection to someone that should be significant in his life, and not even able to make that connection then, his dad's saying, no, I'm fine, I'm good,
Yeah, it's gotta kind of save face, kind of, preserve your pride and not make yourself too vulnerable or open up too much. It's just that complex dance of emotions that a lot of men have to go through to kind of figure out how much do I let out and how much do I just grit my teeth and get through it, You mentioned Gloria Hendry. She was in James couple or she was in James Bond movie Live and Let Die right before this one, so she had a pretty interesting career. D'Urville Martin, he was the guy who played Reverend Rufus there, Tommy's brother. So there's a very interesting cast here. Even Art Lund, who was McKinney, he was the kind of the blue-eyed Irish cop. He actually was a pretty successful kind of big band singer in the 1950s. He recorded the song "Mamzelle," which I don't know if you've seen "Pick Up on South Street." That was a Criterion re-release. So
I love that one.
well, there's that one scene. The woman's name escapes me at the moment, but her kind of death scene. She's singing
Thelma
"Mamzelle."
Ritter.
Yeah, Thelma Ritter. That's right.
I
Thank you.
love her
Yeah,
Mo character in that
Oh
film.
yeah.
She makes
Yeah.
that movie for me.
Well, he recorded the original hit version of "Mamzelle," which made it kind of a standard in 1947. So there's another little connection
Another
there.
connection
Yeah,
there,
just
okay.
interesting little trivia stuff into the lore of this film, if you will. Richard in the previous segment mentioned that Sammy Davis Jr. was originally involved in the development of this story and pitched
Yes,
it
he
to
was
Larry
originally
Cohen.
picked to play the lead, right?
So it's like, Sammy Davis, another incredibly talented gentleman with all sorts of abilities and a screen presence of his own. But him and Fred Williamson, this would have been a different movie with Sammy, with all
Yes.
respect.
I think they made the right
Oh,
choice.
I think so. Yeah, exactly. So, some really interesting stuff going on here. Were there any parts of the movie that didn't sit so well with you? Anything that you wanted? I mean, I talked about this with Richard. These lines were written by a Jewish man, Larry Cohen, and so some of that kind of racial humor, some of that self-deprecating stuff, some of that playing or catering to stereotypes. It's like, okay, I mean, this maybe isn't your right or place to make some of those jokes. I don't know. It's complicated, I'll just say that, because the Jewish people, they've had their own issues with being stigmatized and biased against and discriminated and all of that. So maybe there's some common perspectives, but there's also like, I wouldn't feel comfortable putting those lines in the lines in the mouth of a black character, And yeah, and yet Larry Cohen, he was an entertainer and he just kind of went for it. I guess he was kind of a reckless, go grab you by the throat kind of guy as far as the movies that he made. But I just wanted to kind of get your perspective on any of that.
Yeah, I mean, definitely, I see it as sort of a film, a film of its time. I mean, there's a lot of sort of racial, language that, has been, put in this film, use of certain terms and different, sayings that, some could find offensive, but I just see it as a film, of his time. And I try to sort of view it from that lens, I don't really take too much of, too much offense at it. I kind of see it as, as a little bit of a, exaggerations of certain things in terms of the way these characters are, are portraying, kind of hamming it up a little bit, but,
Even the big kind of the mob hits, there's that one, again, to me, sort of in the aftermath of The Godfather, that pool party with all these kind of very obviously Italian guys, kind of swarming in, jumping over the hedges and tackling people. And it's just a complete massacre. And then there's also the similar scene in one of the Italian restaurants where Tommy's boys are kind of all, kind of prowling around the edges until they come jumping down off of the balcony into the restaurant. And it's just, it's pretty shocking and pretty outrageous. And but again, kind of this vicarious fantasy, kind of living it up, just kind of like getting your revenge, getting your licks in, because this time we got the upper hand,
But yeah, so I just see it as a, with the language and with some of the things that are, that are in here, I think that it serves as a good, like a sort of a point in sort of a time capsule of a film, capturing a lot of the themes and just different things going on. And I'm actually glad for films like this sort of, films that people can watch and kind of be taken aback a little bit, and to sort of, it kind of forces you to kind of think and maybe feel a little uncomfortable, to just sort of remember that, that these times, that this is part of history. This is part of the way people treated people at certain points in history, and to some extent still today in certain, areas. And it's something that I think we should never forget.
And I think, again, establishing sort of, a dominant, strong, authoritative black man in a position of power, we see a lot of that, and that's good. I'm glad that, this has become a lot more of the norm. But, early 70s, this was still pretty radical stuff to be that bold and uncompromising in putting your characters out there on screen. And I think that's another part of the history here, that this was, this is a way of saying, we're going to put the black man in charge here. He's not going to be the sidekick, the subservient. And we're going to, even the street scenes too, just the local landscapes, the street markets, the crowds, the kids, the onlookers. I love that. I like a lot about Wattstax too, putting people on the big screen that had never really been allowed to present themselves as they were. They had to take on a certain role or characteristic. And I think this, like you said, James, is a time capsule, and there's an educational component, especially for younger folks who, never, lived through these times or really grew up in a world where this kind of openly, racial or prejudicial language was just used with such casualness. It wasn't that long ago.
I think it does. I think the film as a whole does a nice job of, dealing with the different themes in terms of the whole racial element, and really establishing the motivation of this young man from the beginning, and then seeing the destructive path of his life. And so helping you understand, why he is doing what he's doing and why he thinks is right, but also seeing, and learning that that the way he's going about it, is corrupting him and is destroying the relationships around him, and it's ultimately going to lead to his downfall. And I think it does a really nice job of showing the whole race thing, corruption, power, revenge, your redemption, just really covering all of those. Bringing all those things together for people to sort of, chew on. And I think they did a nice job putting it together. And, and just the performances of, you know, Williamson, the performance of Miss Hendry, and just, you know, the mother. I think everybody really, you know, brought something to the table. And as we talked about with that wonderful soundtrack,
yeah.
I mean, you know, The Boss, you know, Mama's Dead. I mean, just all these songs just,
yep.
they just stick in your head. And I'm literally going to go on the Spotify and make a playlist out of it. I mean, it's just, it's just really good stuff.
It's an exceptional record. And oh, what's that other one? The song that was sung by a woman. It was kind of the song that was in a bit of a nightclub situation. But that's another really excellent. Okay, gotta look this up here.
Mama Feel Good?
Mama Feel Good, right. That was by Lynn Collins. And I think she does actually have an appearance in the film. And that's another really killer track. Oh, mama, feel good. Oh, mama, feel good. Now I can make my lover reach for the sun when the sun is out. Yeah. And I can make my man forget what he's thinking about. I'm going to have to probably splice a little bits and pieces into this episode just to kind of give listeners a chance of to experience what we're talking about, because I really do feel like that really elevates this movie to a whole different status. And so, you know, I think that's probably a good note to wind things up on. We've had a lot of good things to say about it. It's a film that, you know, may register differently with different viewers. You know, I'm not sure if Criterion would ever take the step of putting this out on disc, but it's one that I feel, you know, with maybe the right supplements or a little commentary track, would be very interesting to dig deeper into. Because I feel like Larry Cohen, the filmmaker, has something going on here, and I'd like to know a little bit more about how this came together. You know, it's in a way, it's a pretty straightforward direct film. Mm-hmm. But, you know, again, you know, putting it on the good sound system, apparently that soundtrack has been sampled quite a bit. Of course, a lot of James Brown has in the hip hop world these days and over the last couple decades. And why not? Those sound bites are just so tasty and so adaptable and just such mm-hmm. great rhythm tracks. You can do so many creative things with it. So. Yeah, I give this a strong recommendation. I know this may not register as Criterion proper to a lot of folks, but I'm really glad that I myself took these few weeks to really dig into this movie, to watch it a few times, to let that soundtrack kind of just permeate my brain and kind of just, you know, give me a lot to groove to as I've thought about what's this movie trying to say and why does it connect with people the way that it does.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I mean, and just some of the things you were saying in terms of the connections, to other films, which is a big reason why, you know, I love this particular medium of cinema, is making those connections. Like, oh, the dad that played, and like the father role here played the father in Nothing But a Man. Like, oh,
yeah,
I did not, you know.
Yeah, or, right.
You know, Gloria Hendry was a Bond girl in the mm-hmm, previous, you mm-hmm. know, like. All the connections, you know?
Yeah, yeah. These are people pursuing their career, putting their talent out there, finding the right roles. And again, I think the casting for this film was right on. They got excellent performances out of people. And, you know, I think they hit the target. And obviously it was enough to inspire a sequel. You know, maybe a little bit, maybe that sequel is even more exploitation in a way than this one was, because they really obviously were just kind of milking it for all it was worth. But Black Caesar, I think, stands alone on its own as a classic of the genre. And I'm really glad that you took the time to have this chat with me about it, James. Thank you so much.
Oh, and thank you so much again for inviting me to dive into it with you. I really enjoyed it.
All right. Well, the next thing I got planned for this podcast is another excursion into black cinema, The Harder They Come, which is a film about the reggae situation and life in Jamaica in the early 70s. So I would like to invite you back for that one. I've got a couple other guests who want to talk about that movie with me, so I'll get into the planning stages of that soon. That is okay. A proper Criterion release, although the DVD is sadly out of print, and I think Shout Factory has the rights now, and they've released a pretty nice Blu-ray edition. I might have to pick that one up myself just to kind of get it in that optimal presentation. I do have the Criterion DVD long out of print, and it is streaming on the Criterion channel as well. So I'll leave viewers and listeners, you know, your own choices of how you want to take it in. But I'm going to try to get that episode planned out and going pretty soon here.
Awesome.
You want to get into The Harder They Come with me there, James?
Absolutely. Let's do it.
All right. Let's talk some reggae next time around. So, listeners, thank you. We're going to send you out on a little James Brown funk soundtrack tip there. Thanks for listening in. Give us your feedback. And, James, looking forward to catching you again and catching up with your latest work on your YouTube channel and on all the socials there. So, thanks again for joining me, and we'll be talking to you all soon.
All right. Thank you, David.
Tell me that you know you want the loving. Tell me, can you want me, boy? Do you love me? I'll make it funky cause you love me, love me. Baby, can you make it funky now? Baby, can you make it funky now? Do it like you wanna do it. Do it like you wanna do it when you need it. Tell me, do you want to be the stuff you just need it? Tell me, do you want it now? Tell me, do you need it now? Tell me. 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 Tell me, do you want to be the stuff you need it? I need it. I need you.